This morning, America's first news starts right after this.
It's October, and what does that mean? Well, it's Geico-ween, of course. Don't be spooked by high rates on car insurance. Geico is brewing up spellbinding savings that they're crafting just for you. See how much you could save. Get a quote today at geico.com.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Trump and Biden begin final pitches. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. On this Monday, October 26, thanks for being with us. Here's what we have for you this hour.
With 8 days until Election Day, President Trump and challenger Joe Biden are in a mad dash to secure the support of undecided voters.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is optimistic that a coronavirus relief bill can be passed by Election Day. Meanwhile, COVID cases are rising.
Hundreds of thousands in Northern California have had their power cut to prevent further wildfires. Meanwhile, another red flag warning has been issued.
And how the pandemic is forcing cuts at Amtrak that may be permanent.
Well, Amtrak isn't unusual in that it is a transportation mode that has been just decimated by the pandemic. Basically, if you're traveling in any sort of way, if that's your business model, you're in really tough luck. Now, the unfortunate part for Amtrak is that they always kind of rely on Congress.
Jessica Werman at CQ Roll Call on how Amtrak is trying to survive the plunge in ridership amid the coronavirus. President Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden are staring at the final full week of campaigning before Election Day next Tuesday. Meanwhile, rising numbers of COVID infections and an outbreak among the staff of Vice President Mike Pence keep the focus of the race on the pandemic. Mr. Trump was in New Hampshire yesterday.
What's happened to New York is so sad with the crime. Democrat run. Only Democrat run. When you have Democrat run, you have problems. You have crime. It's all closed up in many cases, locked down.
Mr. Biden, meanwhile, hosted a virtual grassroots fundraiser.
And all these crises we're seeing today, all the chaos, this hardship and suffering, it didn't have to be this way.
Yeah.
All this anger, division, and hate, you know, in your bones, this is not who we are. And together we can change this.
Today, Mr. Trump visits Pennsylvania for three rallies. Mr. Biden was expected to remain in his home state of Delaware today. Meanwhile, Americans are on pace for the highest voter turnout rate in more than a century, with more than 59.1 million of us already voting. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she's optimistic about Congress passing a coronavirus relief bill before Election Day. She told CNN that a package could pass as soon as this week in the House, which would then leave it up to Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
Well, you know, I'll never give up hope. I'm optimistic. We put pen to paper and have been writing the bill based on what we hope will be the outcome, what they said they would get back to us on.
After initially being opposed to the measure, Mr. McConnell said he'd allow a vote as long as President Trump agrees to sign the bill. Meanwhile, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows is defending the decision by the Trump administration to hold rallies despite the rise in COVID-19 cases.
So here's what we have to do. We're not going to control the pandemic. We are going to control the fact that we get vaccines, therapeutics.
He was on CNN. The U.S. reported nearly 80,000 new infections on Saturday, close to Friday's record of more than 84,000. A Reuters count, by the way, says hospitalizations have hit a two-month high. Well, even though voters today prefer President Trump to handle the economy as much as ever, he remains behind in the final days of the race. That raises two questions. Why? And could the economic issue still propel him to a final days turnaround? In-depth analysis from Jerry Seib, executive Washington editor at The Wall Street Journal. Jerry, take us through this.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We have asked five times this year in our Wall Street Journal NBC News poll, who do you trust to handle the economy more, Joe Biden or President Trump? President Trump has come out on top all five times by margins ranging from 7 points to 11 percentage points. And we've also asked what's the most important issue. And in the most recent survey, and truly in most of the surveys we've taken this year, people say the economy is most important. So you put those two things together and you say, well, aha, President Trump must be winning the election. He must be ahead in the polls because he's trusted on the economy and that's the most important issue, yet that's not what has happened. So that is a bit of a mystery. I think the answer to the mystery is that, well, although people always say the economy is important, there's a whole other set of very emotional kind of persuasive and really important issues that when you add them up together, rival and surpass the economy. You have the coronavirus, obviously. You have climate change. You have the ability to unite the country, and you have race relations. Those are all on the table, and they're all important, and people are passionate about them. And on all those, Joe Biden is scores higher than the president. So, you know, I think it's kind of a case of the economy being maybe the greatest among equals, but the other equals are really important, and it's not enough, I think, to get the president over the top yet. And one of the questions I raised in the column I wrote about all this is whether having the ace card of the economy in your pocket, can he pull it out and still close this race down and move ahead based on that?
All right. So but how does the president then focus on the economy when it's so closely tied to the pandemic right now?
Well, there's two problems there. One is just focusing on the economy because he has not done that as effectively as he might. He hasn't really come up with a very compelling message about what he would do on the economy in a second term. He tends to, you know, sort of lapse into complaints about the way he's being treated sometimes. And so he needs to figure out what his economic message is that actually drives home the point. He talks about it a lot, but not in a specific enough way to kind of add to his advantage. The second problem is, as you suggest, and this is the advantage Joe Biden has, is that I think people tend to conflate getting the coronavirus under control with making economic progress. And if they think that Joe Biden is better at handling the coronavirus than the polls tell you they do, then that's in a way an economic argument for Biden that he's used pretty effectively, that if I'm going to control the coronavirus, I have the better chance of really improving the economy. And that works for a lot of people.
We're speaking with Jerry Seib, executive Washington editor at The Wall Street Journal, about his piece called Voters Tend to Trust Trump on the Economy, Yet He's Behind. Does the president here, say, strike up a message in the final sprint on foreign policy?
I think the president thinks he's got advantages on foreign policy, you know, having helped Arabs and Israelis come together in the Middle East, having confronted China, having some success in bringing Americans in captivity home from abroad. I think there are things he wants to talk about there. I think the problem with that is that I just don't think that's where Americans' focus is right now. It's very much a coronavirus, economy, race relations set of issues. Even the Supreme Court, which looked a few weeks ago as if it was going to be a big subject and the source of a lot of political tension and movement in the end, seems to be receding now compared to these other three big issues, the coronavirus, the economy, and the question of race relations and uniting the country. So I don't think the president is going to make a lot of progress by focusing on foreign policy.
Thanks, Jerry. Jerry Seib, executive Washington editor at The Wall Street Journal. 14 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News.
This year, Michigan businesses have had to adapt. And the Michigan Economic Development Corporation was right there alongside them, helping to connect businesses to new resources, meet new partners, and access the additional capital they needed right from the start. If your business needs support to reach its new potential, the MEDC is available to help in any way we can. Contact us today for customized business assistance at michiganbusiness.org/partnership.
Do business more powerfully during Dell's semi-annual sale. Save up to 45% on Dell computers and servers with Intel Core processors. Also, save on electronics and accessories, plus free shipping on everything and special financing with Dell Business Credit. Call 877-ASK-DELL to talk to a Dell Technologies advisor who can help you find just the right tech. That's 877-ASK-DELL or visit dell.com/businessdeals. Thanks for being with us. Weather forecasters say part of California can expect their most powerful winds of the year through the rest of today and the potential for more raging wildfires. Scott Strenfel, meteorologist for Pacific Gas and Electric, says winds could top 70 miles an hour in some areas.
We have high confidence that this will be the strongest Diablo and fire weather event of the season so far.
And with low humidity and dry vegetation acting as tinder, much of Northern California is under a red flag warning, the highest risk wildfire alert. This man lives in Sonoma County.
It's getting awful tiring, and I've lived here all my life and haven't seen anything like this in the last, like it's been the last 3 years since 2017.
Meanwhile, PG&E cut power to 225,000 customers last evening, and there was the potential for 100,000 more. Thousands of blazes have scorched more than 4 million acres in California this year. That's a record. 31 people have died, and more than 9,000 buildings have been destroyed. It's 20 minutes after the hour on this morning. Here's Jennifer Koschenka.
And now, the three big things you need to know. Number one.
The number of people casting an early ballot in the presidential election now surpasses those who voted early in all of 2016. That's more than 58 million people voting with 8 days to go before Election Day. One out of every four of the voters is either new or infrequent, a sign of a potential record-setting turnout.
Number two.
The latest surge of COVID-19 infections has brought the seven-day average of new cases to heights not seen since the pandemic began. The seven-day average in the U.S. hit 68,767 yesterday, topping the previous peak reported on July 22nd. In Europe, restrictions on activity are back. Italy will close bars and restaurants by 6 p.m. and shut cinemas and gyms altogether. Meanwhile, Melbourne, Australia will largely emerge from lockdown after the city recorded its first day without a new COVID case in more than 4 months. All shops, restaurants, cafes, and bars will be allowed to open, and outdoor contact sports can resume. Travel restrictions will be eased on November 7th.
Number three.
A deeply torn Senate set to confirm Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court tonight. Republicans are overpowering unified Democratic opposition to vote on President Trump's nominee a week before Election Day. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell addressed reporters yesterday.
We're moving this nomination forward. And colleagues, by tomorrow night, we'll have a new member of the United States Supreme Court.
Barrett's confirmation is not in doubt as Senate Republicans seize the opportunity to install a third Trump justice, securing a conservative court majority for the foreseeable future. A strengthening tropical storm Zeta is expected to become a hurricane today as it heads towards Mexico's resort-dotted Yucatan Peninsula and then likely move on for a possible landfall on the central U.S. Gulf Coast at midweek. Zeta yesterday became the earliest ever 27th named storm of the Atlantic season. With a gritty performance, pitcher Clayton Kershaw moved the Los Angeles Dodgers within a victory of their first World Series title since 1988 with a 4-2 win over the Tampa Bay Rays last night. Kershaw says a lot will be going through his head as the team inches closer to the title.
Sitting around one win away from a World Series is going to be hard, especially when you've been in the same hotel for 4 weeks now. But, you know, I think we can wait one more day and we'll all be ready to go.
Game six tomorrow night at Globe Life Field in Arlington.
Why, you know, baseball is just not a momentum sport. The way the Rays won Saturday night with that insane play didn't translate to Sunday.
Whole new game.
Thanks, Jen. 22 minutes after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Today, I'm here with Josh Hunt, Executive Vice President and Chief Business Development Officer at MEDC, the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. Josh, what are Michigan's best selling points?
The biggest selling point for Michigan is our pure Michigan quality of life. We also have a diverse and abundant workforce and a business-friendly environment that we think is unmatched. It's also very connected to global supply chain assets. And through a comprehensive suite of programs and services, we can help businesses grow here in this state and also help provide access to our highly skilled workforce, where we have the highest concentration of engineers and some of the greatest skilled trades talent as well. Here in Michigan, we make things, and we think we can be the convergence of technology and manufacturing, and there is no better place to bring your idea or product from concept to reality than here in Michigan.
To hear more of this interview with Josh Hunt from MEDC, go to thismorningwithgordondeal.com and click on the MEDC microphone. Thanks for being with us. The COVID-19 pandemic may force a reckoning for Amtrak's long-distance routes, bringing about cuts that critics have long urged, but that passenger rail advocates say could undermine the service's mission. It's a story by Jessica Werman, who covers transportation infrastructure for CQ Roll Call. Jessica, explain.
Well, Amtrak isn't unusual in that it is a transportation mode that has been just decimated by the pandemic. Basically, if you're traveling in any sort of way, if that's your business model, you're in really tough luck. Now, the unfortunate part for Amtrak is that they always kind of rely on Congress. The Congress generally spends about $2 billion a year, the federal government does, to fund Amtrak. So That's the beginning marker. Now, add a pandemic to that and plummeting ridership, and they need a whole heck of a lot more money. The latest ask is like $4.9 billion for next year. That's their most recent ask for the next fiscal year. Now, the problem is that it's very, very hard for them to break even on this. And there are people who argue Amtrak isn't really meant to make a profit. It's not designed to. It is basically designed to provide a service to the American people, much like the post office. The problem is that they're hurting so much that there gets to be a point where you kind of go, okay, so what has to be cut in order for this to survive?
Okay, so explain some of the cuts and changes that are underway now, because there have been layoffs, right? Routes have been reduced.
Yes, there have been layoffs. The initial cuts, the first couple of months, were some small cuts to the Northeast Corridor, to some of the state-supported routes. But the long-distance cuts have been the most recent cuts, and those are probably the least profitable of all of the routes that Amtrak does. However, they are probably the most politically protected. So Congress is furious about the idea of cutting these from daily to one time a week. And the issue is that they kind of go, well, if you don't have a daily train to ride, you're going to get out of the habit of taking these long distance routes, which are not that profitable to begin with. On top of all that, it's a workforce that was 18,500. They cut 2,050 jobs in October, and probably they'll wind up cutting, if they don't get additional aid, like 2,500 more jobs later on this year.
I'm speaking with Jessica Werman, transportation infrastructure reporter at CQ Roll Call. Her piece is called Hit by a Pandemic, Amtrak is Making Cuts That May Endure. There was one person in your story who said maybe there just needs to be a rethink of the investment. What did that mean? Like, what could be done, I guess?
Well, I mean, a lot of these modes of transportation, be it Amtrak, be it transit, there's been kind of a sea change because of the pandemic, because people stay home more. I mean, they just don't travel like they did before March. And so the argument from one of the folks I talked to was, you know, this might be a good chance to really look at Amtrak and say, why are we doing this? I mean, what's the point of having these specific routes that are losing tons of money, losing tons of taxpayer dollars? I mean, is it really justifiable for us to be spending taxpayer money on this, particularly when the needs are so vast and so deep just across the country because of the pandemic?
Thanks, Jessica. Jessica Werman, she covers transportation infrastructure for CQ Roll Call. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. So if you're working from home, are you still dressing for work? While we can all understand not wearing a tie, going to the other extreme, like an old t-shirt, is a little too casual. If you need to upgrade the work-from-home wardrobe, try Cuts Clothing. Technical apparel for the sport of business. GQ called them the only shirt worth wearing. They combine an athletic, tailored-looking fit with their custom-engineered, wrinkle-free, ultra-soft Pika fabric for a new level of fit, fabric, and function. I gotta say, I love wearing my Cut shirts. They're tough, they're durable, yet still flexible, willing to move with me. And now Cuts is finally out with their new polos and hoodies made with their custom Hyperloop French Terry fabric. Try Cuts and save. Cuts is loved by your favorite athletes, entrepreneurs, and even podcast hosts. Get 15% off your first order by going to cutsclothing.com/Gordon. That's cutsclothing.com/Gordon for 15% off the only shirt worth wearing. cutsclothing.com/Gordon.
Taking the day's information and helping you make sense of it all. We're here for you every morning. You're listening to America's First News, This Morning with Gordon Deal.
Thanks for spending time with us. Welcome into Monday, October 26. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Some of our top stories and headlines: COVID cases still rising. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi optimistic a coronavirus stimulus bill could pass this week. Northern California under a red flag warning for wildfires. Louisiana and the Florida Panhandle watching Tropical Storm Zeta. The Senate to approve Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett today. Sunday Night Football, Arizona beat Seattle. World Series resumes tomorrow. And the fourth graders who restored a Nebraska's woman faith in humanity. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, police departments have faced increased scrutiny from politicians and protesters over their funding and treatment of minorities since the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis police custody back in May. Officials in several cities said they now use misconduct claims
to guide police reforms with the goal of reducing incidents that can spur potentially costly lawsuits. It's a story by Scott Calvert, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Scott, what did you find?
You know, obviously, there have been a lot of high-profile incidents involving, you know, alleged police misconduct, and those have resulted in some pretty hefty settlements just in the last couple of months. You know, there was the Breonna Taylor settlement in Louisville, which was $12 million to her family. And we were curious to take a deeper look at this. And so back in July, we set out trying to get some answers by reaching out to the 20 cities and counties around the U.S. that have the largest police departments. And we basically asked them, how much have you paid out to resolve allegations of police misconduct and civil rights violations since 2015? And the answer is more than $2 billion in that time span.
Incredible. All right, so who has paid out how much, Scott?
Well, a big chunk of that, about half really, is New York City, which is around, I think, $1.1 billion or so that New York City has paid out in that time period. Also large amounts from Chicago, Los Angeles County, the city of Los Angeles, and Philadelphia is sort of up there, but it kind of goes down from there. So those are some of the biggies.
One of the things you mentioned here, too, was Chicago now has this chief risk officer. Well, what does this woman do?
Right. So, you know, obviously cities are and counties are concerned about this on a number of levels. It's not just dollars and cents, but that's part of it as well. And so every dollar that you pay out in a settlement is a dollar that you don't have for whatever kind of services you might want to provide, right? And so so what Chicago has done is a year ago, Mayor Lori Lightfoot created this new position, chief risk officer, and hired Tamika Puckett for the job. And one of the things that she's doing is using claims data to help guide reform processes so that they can change policies and procedures with an eye to preventing these sorts of things from happening again, which is a good thing, like I said, on a lot of levels, including financially. And so they have changed the search warrant execution policy in Chicago so that you now have to have two officers in full uniform, among other things. And they also have changed the vehicle pursuit policy. You know, they tightened the rules on when police can pursue another driver. And that's because whenever that happens, you know, there are risks to pedestrians and other motorists. And when you've had these bad incidents in the past, you know, and not only do you have people being hurt and sometimes killed, but that also gives rise to these lawsuits and big settlements.
We're speaking with Scott Calvert, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He's written a piece entitled Police Rethink Policies as Cities Pay Millions to Settle Misconduct Claims. How about in Houston, Scott? What's happening there?
Well, you know, Houston actually is an interesting example of one. That's the only city or county that did not provide us with the payout data. They said they just didn't have it. So unfortunately, we don't have details on that. But we did talk to the police chief in Houston, who happens to be the president of the Major Cities Chiefs Association, which is a group of large cities. And you know, he says, look, you know, there are consequences to these payouts, and it's something that chiefs pay close attention to. Not only what's happening in their city, but what's happening in other places. And, you know, his point is that, as he puts it, litigation that visits City A today will more than likely visit City B tomorrow. So they're very, very keenly aware of what's happening in this area.
All right. So you talked to, I know, the executive director of the National Association of Police Organizations. What do they say about all this?
Sure. So that's Bill Johnson. And basically what he said a couple of things. I mean, one concern he has is that cities may be a little bit too quick to settle because they're worried about going in front of a jury. And so in his view, they may be too quick to settle cases that are either borderline or maybe frivolous, just to sort of make them go away and, you know, write somebody a check. And he said the problem with that is that, you know, that can damage the reputations of officers, and it's sort of not fair to them. He did acknowledge that, you know, first of all, you have officers who make mistakes and sometimes with tragic consequences. And he said there are some officers, you know, who commit crimes and sort of deliberately, you know, violate policies. And he said, you know, we don't want to work with people like that. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. I mean, there's definitely some concern there, though, on his part that, you know, that cities are a little bit too quick to settle some of these cases.
Thanks, Scott. Scott Calvert, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. 20 minutes in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us. Welcome into Monday. It is time now for the mic drop with This Morning's Mike Gavin.
Good morning. Well, we all make mistakes, and they're usually a bad thing that we try to avoid, unless you're this guy from Michigan, whose mess up made him very rich. Samir Mazahem of Dearborn Heights told lottery officials he accidentally bought two identical tickets for a Mega Millions drawing using the lottery's website. He says he was pretty bummed out at first when he found out he bought two tickets with the same numbers. The mistake proved fortunate, however, when he matched the five white balls drawn, earning each ticket a $1 million prize. The big winner says he plans to buy a new home with his winnings and put the rest into savings.
Yeah, a $2 million oops. That's unbelievable.
I mean, I guess he would have won anyway, right? He would have won the $1 million. I guess. But yeah, he wasn't happy about it, and right. Now he's ecstatic.
That's incredible.
We don't make those kind of mistakes.
No, right. Our mistakes would cost us $2 million.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
some IRS notification or something like that.
Yeah.
Wow. Hey, honey, I made a mistake. Won $2 million today.
Yeah.
Wow.
Not bad. High fives for everybody.
Yes.
And we told you last week about the asteroid that scientists say could fly awfully close to the Earth the day before Election Day. Now, there's a very slim chance that the space rock could survive Earth's atmosphere and reach the planet's surface. Despite that fact, one cookie company, thankfully for us, isn't taking any chances. In a video published to their YouTube page, Oreo says it's built an asteroid-proof bunker in the Arctic to store Oreos and powdered milk in case of a disaster. In a Twitter post, the company wrote, "Each cookie pack is wrapped in protective Mylar, which can keep our cookies safe from temperatures of negative 80 to 300 degrees Fahrenheit." They also explained that the vault also contains vials of powdered milk, which reportedly only need to have powdered snow added before being ready to have Oreos dunked in it. They went on to provide the coordinates of the vault, but also warned that there is a coded lock on the door in case any cookie fans try to break in prematurely.
Yeah, because cookie fans often wander into the Arctic, right?
Right, yeah, yes.
Foraging for food.
I have to say, this is a pretty cool little video they put together. They made it seem very, very real.
Okay.
Like they really have been constructing a huge bunker in the Arctic, which, you know, they most likely were not, but very cool marketing video on their part.
The question I have for Oreos remains, why do we make original Oreos when we have learned the beauty of the double stuff?
And there's even more stuff now, right? We got like extra stuff and triple stuff
or whatever.
You know, the most stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, the stuff is limitless. And yet somehow, and those are probably the most popular ones still, I'm guessing. The original ones are probably still the most popular. Maybe there's some people who just can't stand all the sweetness.
My wife buys them, and I don't know why. I mean, listen, it doesn't stop me from eating them from fistfuls at a time. But
right.
I don't understand. Just get the double stuff.
Are there fewer calories, maybe?
Oh, maybe.
Are they almost the diet version? Diet
this,
Oreos?
This is her trying to tell me to stop eating the Oreos.
Right. It's bad enough you're eating all the Oreos, but we need to limit the stuff.
Right. Thanks, Mike. 13 minutes in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Do business more powerfully during Dell's semi-annual sale. Save up to 45% on Dell computers and servers with Intel Core processors. Also, save on electronics and accessories, plus free shipping on everything and special financing with Dell Business Credit. Call 877-ASK-DELL to talk to a Dell Technologies advisor who can help you find just the right tech. That's 877-ASK-DELL or visit dell.com/businessdeals. Thanks for spending time with us. Welcome into Monday. Here's something to consider as some of us make our way back to the office. Do employees have the right to free political speech at work? The Wall Street Journal says the bottom line is employers have wide latitude to limit employees' speech, political or otherwise, that might offend other workers. And they can take steps to restrict those who do make political statements. That includes wearing a Trump hat or a Biden T-shirt on the job. Keep in mind, the First Amendment only prohibits the government from restricting free speech, not your employer. Also, public employees are protected by state and federal constitutional provisions, while workers at private companies are subject to their employer's rules on political speech. One exception is if that private employer receives federal financial assistance. Now, some states have political speech protections, but even where political speech is protected, an employer can discipline or dismiss an employee if the political expression interferes with the business
or disrupts fellow workers. 8 minutes now in front of the hour on this morning. Once again, here's Jennifer Koshenka.
And now, the three big things you need to know. Number one.
President Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden are down to the final full week of campaigning before the election as surging coronavirus cases and a COVID-19 outbreak within Vice President Mike Pence's staff keep the focus on the race on the pandemic. Trump claimed progress in combating the disease even as the U.S. set records in recent days for daily infections, while Pence forged ahead with campaigning yesterday despite close aides testing positive. More than 59 million people have already voted, a pace that could lead to the highest turnout rate in more than a century.
Number two.
The FBI is investigating a fire set yesterday in a Boston ballot drop box holding over 120 ballots, with Massachusetts election officials describing the incident as a deliberate attack. 35 ballots were damaged. Meanwhile, a Georgia county is ground zero for what may be the first ransomware attack to hit election infrastructure this political season. The attack on Hall County was disclosed on October 7th, but the impact is only now coming to light. Among the county's affected systems, a voter signature database.
Number three.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she's still optimistic about Congress passing a coronavirus relief package before November 3rd. She told CNN that Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin was going to take the weekend to review a list of concerns House Democrats have.
Well, you know, I never give up hope. I'm optimistic. We put pen to paper and have been writing the bill based on what we hope will be the outcome, what they said they would get back to us on.
And Pelosi says she'll continue working to get a relief bill passed as soon as possible. Hundreds of thousands of people lost power in dozens of California counties yesterday as weather forecasters predict the most powerful winds of the year and the potential for more raging wildfires. This Lafayette resident says the power shutoff is just one more obstacle.
Everything is just so much harder right now because of COVID and and fires and power outages, and it's just, you know, everybody's saying I can't wait for 2020 to be over.
Pacific Gas and Electric had shut off electricity to 225,000 customers by last night. Quite the find for a North Carolina man with a metal detector. The Charlotte resident was on a metal hunting trip in Maine when he turned up a 222-year-old coin on the grounds of a church. The copper penny was dated 1798, making it a product of the first decade of U.S. minted money.
That's dedication. Yeah. You live in North Carolina, but you actually bring your metal detector to Maine?
Some hobbyists do that kind of stuff.
All right. Thank you, Jen. 6 minutes in front of the hour. On This Morning, America's First News. So a woman from Nebraska has been reunited with a long-lost handbag stolen 3 years ago after a pair of fourth graders found it while playing. 6 News Television in Omaha says Eli Rempe and Sam Yarpe were playing with friends near a creek by the Papillion soccer fields when they spotted a purse filled with old credit cards and gift cards. With a little help from a parent and the magic of Facebook, Mallory Pittman Morris was identified as the owner. Later that day, the boys were excited to personally bring it to her home in Papillion. 3 years ago, Ms. Pittman Morris told Fox News that someone smashed her car window and snatched her purse while she and her husband watched their son play soccer. Though she filed a police report and canceled the cards, her bag never turned up. Happily surprised to have her bag back after all this time, the woman said the boy's good deed has lifted her spirits. As a small token of her appreciation, she thanked the boys with a bag of candy for each. She says their thoughtfulness has restored her faith in humanity. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News. Want to know what's really scary? Seeing just how much you could have been saving on car insurance by switching to Geico. It's almost as scary as watching your dog growl at the wall and realize he sees something you don't. Get a quote at geico.com.